treaty, because I think this is what set the foundations for the ongoing developments in the Eurozone today as well. The principles that the European Union was going to move towards the flexibility of markets, of labor markets, and the overall conditions of liberalization that took place after the Maastricht Treaty basically signified the end of the social contract as it had developed in the 60s, from the 50s onwards, to many Western European countries. Not Greece, however. And I think this is important to keep in mind, that a number of countries in the so-called European periphery share these characteristics that distinguish it from the a core of European Union countries in the northwestern part of Europe. Having said that, I think it's important to keep in mind, because as the Eurozone project evolved from the last 10 years, actually, in 2011, it's going to be 10 years since the foundation, it has gone through a boom and bust phase. I think now it's still unclear to whether it is sustainable as a project, and you know, I think there's all these views about whether it can be as complete as it was designed to be, but I think it's nevertheless interesting that it was planned without the eventuality of a crisis such as the one we're currently going through. I think it is pretty amazing to think that it was designed, but not with a crisis of that magnitude in mind. Perhaps a sign of the times and the confidence that people had at the time. The issue that, and Greece, I'm going to talk a little bit about Greece now, of who started the crisis and why it started. I think it's important to keep in mind that it has two aspects. One is the domestic issues that are for Greece to solve, and the other one is for the issues that the European Union has imposed in one way or another, with the negative and positive aspects of the word, to countries such as Greece. This comes as not surprising, as when at the same time when issues of legitimacy began to arise, and the main issue of the Greek government, that the Greek government is facing at the moment, is whether it has the legitimacy to push forward with the reforms that it's trying to push forward for the last year or so. And that is no small issue, because it relates to the issue of the legitimacy of the EU as a whole, plus the presence from for nearly 6 months now of the IMF in the Eurozone. And this is also very a novelty itself. It was the idea, I think, when the euro was created, that there was going to be all sorts of innovations in the Eurozone. It's going to be devoid of the political instability that has plagued national currencies. There is going to be a new era of stability. What they did not account for in the central design of the whole Eurozone experiment is the fact that at some point the IMF might be called in to bring in stability. And it has this, I think, highlights a major contradiction between the fact that Eurozone is calling the IMF to solve, to impose austerity on a country, when the IMF always has as its first policy to depreciate national currencies. So you have this major contradiction, that IMF is called in a Eurozone area, and that includes more than one countries, to impose austerity measures by not being able to depreciate national currency, because this is what the first thing that always the IMF has done, and with very dubious results. And I think this is always the case. That is why it received a lot of resistance in Greece, and it still is not clear to me and to many other people how the austerity measures are going to work and to what effect. I mean, in fact, it seems to be a constant renewal of the memorandum agreement between the Greek government and the IMF and the European Commission too, that show that the European Union crisis in Greece is far from resolved. I don't know whether Greece is going to be a catalyst again for another I hope this time positive developments in the European Union, but it certainly doesn't seem to have solved any problems. And with this, I mean basically the national debt, which continues to grow, and it's very unlikely that anyone's going to borrow Greece, lend, sorry, anyone's going to lend Greece by 2014 when the debt is going to be up to 170% of GDP. So I think with that kind of gruesome number, I'm going to leave it here. doesn't bode very well for the future, but this is how the situation is at the moment from a Greek side point of view, at least. So thank you for the moment. I don't know, so how shall we go around you? Are you going to talk about Greece too? Or
Yeah? A little bit. Okay. Yeah. Shall I?
Yeah, please.
Well, it's really humbling for me to be invited to talk on the crisis of the European Union and the Eurozone in particular. Humbling in the sense that this has been and continues to be an experiment, I mean the EU that is, of historical proportions and with a global consequence. But I'm going to try to add my two cents to the discussion here. The first question is whether the Eurozone is in crisis. And I guess my short answer is yes, it is in crisis. The traditional definition of crisis in the dictionary has usually a couple of dimensions. One is instability. Political, economic, social, and such. The other is turning point. I think in this particular context, the EU qualifies for both. So I think the answer is clear, at least in my mind. But if crisis is about turning points, the next interesting question here is, a turning point in what direction? And in my view, there is a couple of directions here. There's a worst case scenario, there is a best case scenario in my view, and there is a lot in between. The best case scenario for me is for the EU and its leadership to realize, coming out of this or during this crisis, that you cannot have your cake and eat it too. In other words, I think the EU needs to realize that you cannot have a monetary union without a fiscal union of some significant consequence. I think this message comes loud and clear out of the crisis. But I'm not going to elaborate very much on this because, hopefully during the discussion I will have the opportunity to do so. But let me for a moment step back a little bit. Let me try to provide some perspective. In my view, the European Union project, or experiment, as sometimes I like to call it, has been a child of war experience. Pretty much like the Bretton Woods institutions have been. And it has been, since its inception, an experiment whose primary and strategic drivers have been not so much economic. Economics have been really the tools. The primary strategic drivers, in my view, have been ensuring peace and stability in a region that has been ravaged by two major wars. So and it was partly also in response to the Cold War and such. So it was thought that through an ever deepening economic and political integration, and therefore interdependence, the participants, the members of the EU, would effectively manage to create that win-win situation, which would then give them the incentive to cooperate on not only economics but also on making the European region a global player, peacefully and with stability within the region. I also think that some of the major breakthroughs for the better in terms of the history of the European Union have happened through crisis. For instance, and this is my reading, I feel that the currency crisis of the early 90s posed for the very first time a major dilemma for the European Union. And the dilemma was, how can we build an edifice in such a way so that speculative attacks of this nature would never happen again? It was not enough, you see, to blame George Soros for what happened in the early 90s, because that would amount to actually, you know, shooting the messenger. So George Soros simply understood, and others, that this was very much a great opportunity for him and others to actually place one-way bets against certain currencies in the context of the ERM, the exchange rate mechanism at that point. So the British pound got ejected, the Spanish peseta got ejected, the Italian lira got ejected out of the exchange rate mechanism. And then the question was, which way are we going to go now? It seems to me that this crisis propelled Europe faster than it would have happened otherwise to monetary union and the euro. And that option, namely going for an extreme form of a fixed exchange rate regime, was very much consistent with the strategic objective, which was this ever-deepening economic and political integration of the European Union in the name of primarily stability and security. So it seems to me now that this crisis, right, with Greece as a catalyst, the unintended consequence of this crisis may be, and I hope it is, that will propel Europe faster than it would have been the case in the direction of a fiscal union which would complete this edifice and make it sustainable for the long run. Personally, I'm an enthusiastic supporter of the EU experiment. However, I'm not naive. I understand, or at least I think I'm not naive, because I understand that going in that direction, and going in that direction credibly and quickly, is a huge political question, because you are dealing with sovereign nations. And it is not, they have ceded sovereignty already to go for monetary union. So now going for a fiscal union, if that's the choice, which is a big question mark anyway, and it is a point of debate, would be a very difficult thing. Very difficult thing. The alternative, speaking of directions, the alternative, the worst case scenario would be this. I have been on the ground several times since the crisis erupted, at the epicenter of this earthquake, namely Greece. And my sense of it is that if the current policy stance continues, through the the dictates of the European Commission, the IMF, and the European Central Bank, and the Greek government, at some point, there's going to be a huge political block which would not allow these kinds of reforms to continue at this rate and at this pace in Greece. And then the political / economic calculus in Greece might dictate or make it clear to a majority of people, including political leaders, that maybe Greece should opt out, should just exit. And if it was just that as an outcome, nobody would be particularly interested, I guess, except for the Greeks. But My concern here is the domino effect. If the calculus of the Greeks points in that direction, maybe the calculus of others might point to the same direction. And then the edifice of the Eurozone would be at a risk. This is a systemic issue we're talking about. There's no doubt that there is huge responsibility on the part of the Greeks and the Greek public finance management. There's no doubt, and this is extensively discussed. But what I'm trying to focus on here is something that brings many more stakeholders together, and that's the question of what is in the best interests of the European Union. So that's the worst case scenario in my view. And if that happened and the Eurozone were to actually become a thing of the past, I'm afraid that the European Union will become a thing of the past. And that would then pose the question of regional stability and security in the region again. And that, to me, would be a tremendously challenging question to answer in the absence of this civilizing force, which to me is the European Union. So I will leave it there.
Thank you, Theo. I will pass on the microphone literally and the floor to Ulrich Best.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure. I'm not an economist. I'm a political geographer. So what I'll be saying is maybe coming from a different perspective. Maybe Burkhard is going to fill in some of the economist perspectives that I'm going to have to leave out. So the EU, you said it was maybe something like a revolutionary project. You like the EU, and I'd have to say I'm actually fairly neutral when it comes to the EU. As neutral as I'm when it comes to Canada, Germany, or Switzerland, maybe. And I think it's actually not a revolutionary project in there having been any kind of revolution. It's maybe even closer to something like a counter-revolutionary project, if at all I'd want to reference revolution when it comes to the EU. It is a state that's there organizing administration, governance, accumulation, and so on. So I'd say I'm fairly neutral towards it. There's nothing much I can do about it. As an elite, I'm partly profiting from it, obviously, but others are not. Yeah. So that's just my first note of difference I'm trying to set, and I'm sure we'll be. I'm just trying to get a couple of points to argue out there. So then, as a geographer, what does the EU do? And is any of these things that the EU does, is anything in danger from what I'm seeing? So the EU organizes mutual market access, organizes free trade between the EU countries, which I think we can pretty much rely on this maintaining to be the case, this being the case for the future, no matter whether Greece or Portugal leave the EU or not. Yeah, I think that's nothing, that's what the EU does, that's what the states in that area are going to continue doing. Yeah? It also organizes the mobility of the labor force and an international training of the labor force, and it also organizes the training of something like an international elite. And I think we can be pretty certain that the EU is also going to continue to do that. That the mobility of the labor force, the openness of borders, and at the same time, the closure of borders towards the outside, various filtering mechanisms, and so on, are going to remain in place because they are this mobility of labor, closure of the outside borders, that's in the interest of the countries, the states, as they set them. So I think that's also going to remain more or less in place. What else does the EU do? Maybe one of the more ambitious projects is that the EU has something like a territorial social policy, trying to balance out the development of the regions, by having regional subsidies, regional development funds, and so on. And this is something where I see something changing right now already, with the focus moving away from the regions and the focus moving towards the states, back to the states again. That is something that is already changing, I think. Potentially. I'm not sure whether they're shaking my head or just gymnastics. Okay. So I think that's certainly something. So the regions, I'd say, are out of the picture at the moment. It's about states, making sure that the states are somehow in balance. And that is also what the crisis, initially when the crisis arose, at least from what I've seen in Germany, is that it was initially considered to be this moment of the reaffirmation of the state. Strong governance, Gutenberg, former Minister of the Economy, fighting for Germany against the evil American companies, and so on. So it was an increased stress on state agency against other states and also against foreign companies. So that's one thing where I see things, one aspect where I see things changing, possibly. And finally, what else does the EU do? Manages legal convergence. Things like a charter of human rights, anti-discrimination legislation, and so on, which I think isn't greatly in danger either. And finally, I think one of the last aspects of EU policy is major joint investments, infrastructure projects, making sure that the highways actually meet up at the borders and don't somehow miss one another. And I think these major infrastructure projects are also going to remain. When it comes to highways, I guess maybe the bridge between Germany and Denmark is maybe not going to be built, but it looked like it was going to be a big waste of money anyway. Pipelines are going to continue being built from all directions. So I think that's also not going to change. So these are just some of the points I wanted to raise. I don't see the crisis really, but that's maybe a bit of a pointed argument I'm trying to make here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome.
Please. Yeah, thanks for inviting me. And I think I can begin right away by contradicting Uli and saying I think we have a major crisis, a euro crisis, a eurozone crisis, a crisis of the European Union. It was triggered in sort of its sovereign debt component by the global financial crisis, but I would argue very much it was a crisis waiting to happen. And it had enough endogenous factors on the ground that it was easy to, you know, light the match and get the fire going. Much has already been said, and I think I can be brief. I just wanted to raise three points. The first relates to the nature and the origin of the crisis that we see today, and point two and three relate to the impact and to questions how the crisis can be resolved going forward. So the first point about how we got here in the first place, and I think it's a clear case of chickens coming home to roost. It's a crisis that was implanted in the project at the very beginning, and Sarkis correctly pointed out you need to go back into history to understand where we end up now, and we don't have time to do that now, but what is very important to understand about the Maastricht Treaty is that it was a political treaty, very much about recasting Europe in the aftermath of the end of the Soviet Union, of German unification, of redrawing a picture of Europe, but really in political terms. So the euro was a political project, a symbol for Europe coming together, for Germany becoming firmly embedded in this European enterprise. And Germans, so to speak, bringing their Deutschmark to the altar of, you know, the final European wedding. The problem was, with this nice political design, is that the EU was getting ahead of itself, or was putting the cart before the horse. As economists at the time already said, you do not have what economists call an optimal currency area. The European Union countries were, and still are, very heterogeneous. They have very different needs in terms of the economic cycle. They have different interest rates needs at the same time. So if we look, for example, at Ireland, take the example of Ireland and Germany. For Ireland, I mean, there are lots of issues here, the property bubble, lack of regulation, lots of mistakes being made. But one problem was also that with the euro, all of a sudden, I have a European Central Bank setting uniform interest rates across a very heterogeneous area. And the Irish party could just go on and on and on because the Germans needed low interest rates. So the Irish party just went out of control because there was no central bank stepping on the interest rate brake. So that was a construction mistake to begin with, the kind of setting of a one-size-fits-all monetary policy. That in itself was dangerous, and Ireland is maybe the best example. What was even more dangerous was that there was, as Theo had already mentioned, and he hopes that now this crisis is the opportunity to fix that problem today, is that there was no coordination of fiscal and economic policy. So you would essentially take away some very important economic instruments from member states, that is currency depreciation, sort of beggar my neighbor policies, which just devaluate your currency and come to offset the cycle in that way, and that has been taken away. At the same time, there's no coordination between fiscal policies, and then of course you have the moral hazard problem of if I wanted to be polemic, of course I could now from a German perspective rant about Greek statistics. That's actually a word that has entered the Brussels jargon, Greek statistics. Then you have, it was very clear, although there was legislation to the contrary, that within that union, there would be, in fact, be a kind of solidarity in the sense that, there would be responsibility at the European level if things were to go wrong. Of course, curiously, they never thought about things might really go wrong as they did. The coordination was never possible because it would have been a cut into the fabric of sovereignty in the member states. So member states would never agree to fiscal coordination, but they would of course willingly free ride on the policies of other countries. So, the Greeks could for a long time, without having to fear to be penalized, overspend in those terms. There were those nice convergence criteria that countries had to meet to enter the union, but of course they were never enforced. And obviously we know now that Greece and Italy never met the criteria in the first place. They should have never entered the euro area. But there was a lot of hypocrisy also on the part of the big countries, because guess what? Germany and France also sinned against those criteria. They didn't meet them. What happened? Nothing. So it became clear to everybody, we have a common currency, but we have no coordination of fiscal policies. The convergence criteria are a joke. They won't be enforced. So it's beggar my neighbor, it's free riding, it's moral hazard. And well, and then you only needed a crisis to, you know, to wait for this to spin out of control. So my first point, there's this fundamental disconnect between the common currency and a lack of coordination. And that was really, you know, entirely predictable that at one point in history this would come to haunt, you know, Europe, to have put, you know, forward a political project that didn't have the necessary economic foundations. The second point about impact and potential resolution, it's what I would call the lack of solidarity of a social contract between countries. The European Union is a very funny, you called it a state. I think it lacks certain key features of a state, because it is not, in modern terms, a welfare state. It doesn't have an economic policy. It has a monetary policy, but it does not have a welfare state. So the European Union does not go into those critical areas that people really care about: healthcare, education, welfare payments. So the problem is, the EU was never there, and member states don't want it to go there, but if I want to have this coordination, the fiscal and economic coordination, I need to go into this area. But the fundamental problem is the EU doesn't have legitimacy to go there, really. There's no European political system where Europeans could come together and debate how much redistribution do we want, how much education, how much healthcare. Do we want to afford or have as Europeans? So there's no way that Europeans can actually have that debate. It's not trust me, it's not happening in the European Parliament, because the European Union doesn't have the competence to go there. But that would be necessary to create a kind of social contract. And I do not mean the kind of social contract, shall we bail out, you know, the Greeks or not. It's a contract, yes, if we want a joint fiscal policy, we need to talk about this on what are our priorities as Europeans, on what do we want to spend money. And there's no institutional mechanism, there's no political mechanism now to do that. So that's sort of a pessimistic outlook on how do you get the necessary political process going if you wanted to use this opportunity. And a third point, I think that's something that is sort of underemphasized in the debate. I see another gap, a solidarity gap, in terms of the impacts in different countries, and especially in the most affected countries. Again, there's terrible jargon here, you know, the pigs they were called at some point, which tells us a lot about, you know, unveiled stereotyping still being present in Europe, but that's a different story. What I was trying to say is the gap is there between generations. The injustice, and I call it injustice, in many European countries, the main burden of the restructuring, economic adjustment, is carried by the younger generation. So the party, so to speak, that I talked about, was celebrated, was consumed by the older generation with, you know, safe jobs, safe pensions, safe healthcare, everything you can imagine. I mean, they're trying to adjust that as well, but that's going to be very difficult. And the younger generation is really left out there. Look at youth unemployment in Spain, which I think is at 25%, Adrian?
Higher
than that, probably. In other countries, Italy, Greece, the same. The young generation is being shut out, is being made to pay for those mistakes that were made 10, 15 years ago. And I think that's pretty dramatic, and that might you know, be very explosive going forward. There's not only a lack of solidarity between countries, there's a lack of solidarity between generations as well.
Thank you, Berkhard. I think now we can elicit the views from our guests in the audience.